You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you're interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support. This movie review also comes for subscribers at Time Lord level or above, an uncut, unedited, longer video version of the review. Become a subscriber and check it out.
Do you love sci-fi, horror, and fantasy films? Then grab a badge for Otherworlds Film Festival, the country's premier sci-fi film festival. There'll be Q&As, panels, parties, and mixers. Rub elbows with up-and-coming and established filmmakers, as well as like-minded filmgoers. Come celebrate our 7th year, December 3rd through 6th, at the Galaxy Highland in Austin, Texas. Badges are now for sale at OtherworldsFilmFest.com. That's OtherworldsFilmFest.com.
Been not exactly quiet about my feelings about horror writer director Mike Flanagan, which is to say that I haven't been totally in love with everything he's done. It's been close. I really, really think that this guy is one of the people who is part of this new horror renaissance. He's not as arty as someone like, and I'm blanking on the name of the person who did Midsommar and Hereditary.
Ari Aster.
Yeah. He's not like doing these crazy retro gore fests that are happening, like are coming out of Indonesia that are wonderful right now, but he is doing his own thing. It's like he's making the films that should have been done correctly in the 80s, but weren't.
Yeah.
He's very much an 80s film horror director, but the guy's like, oh, here's where they did it really bad because no one had any confidence in horror. I really think horror is great and I'm going to do it good. And he has made one good thing after another. My God, he actually made a great sequel to The Shining. I mean, that shouldn't be possible. Shut up, Rob.
I wish I was Dr. Sleep.
You got to get some more rest, Brad. He made one of the best things on television, The Haunting of Hill House, based on the book The Haunting of Hill House, which is also itself had been adapted into films called The Haunting. You know, I mean, some people argue that the original movie is better. I won't. I think the television adaptation he did is not only one of the finest horror things in television history, it's decidedly the best version of the book, even if it is a completely recontextualized version of it. So everyone's like, are you going to do a sequel to that? That felt kind of finished. He's like, well, yes and no. I'm going to do another miniseries. I'm going to bring back some of the same cast playing completely different characters. It's going to be another totally recontextualized version of a classic book of horror, but it's not going to be that one. It's not going to be those same characters. So what does he do? Of all the things he could have chosen, he chose Turn of the Screw, which has been adapted 8,796.5 times. I mean, it was even adapted into a movie this fucking year called The Turning. And I was like, ooh, I want to see the porn version called The Screwing. Anyway, so
thanks, everybody, for joining us tonight.
Aruga!
If it existed, it assuredly would have been better than that film.
But The Haunting of Bly Manor is the name of this new adaptation of it. It does bring back Victoria Pedretti, Oliver Jackson Cohen, Henry Thomas, Mike Flanagan's wife, Kate Siegel, and Carla Gugino, who were in the first season, to play very different roles. In fact, Carla Gugino is the wraparound narrator character who we see is at a wedding. Feels like not everyone is really familiar with even who she is, but she's like an older lady. They've grayed her up a bit, and she's like, you want to talk about scary places, let me tell you a ghost story. By the way, it's gonna take a really long time, which is right. It's like she was like, yeah, this is a really long story. I mean, like, nobody got up. Nobody's like, well, we got an early morning.
It's like, we have the wedding to go to like tomorrow.
Right.
She crashed the wedding reception and told a 9-hour story, you guys. That's pretty epic.
Man. But anyway, so she tells the story of Bly Manor, which is Turn of the Screw, which is a young governess played by Victoria Pedretti, who has come to London. She's an American, and she is hired by Henry Thomas, E.T.'s best friend, to come be the nanny at this ridiculously huge, crazy, super old, beautiful mansion out in the countryside that nobody in the town wants anything to do with, naturally. I kept expecting that speech from the 90s, The Haunting. I don't stay after night in the dark, in the cold. The kids seem nice enough. They're like 8 or 9, 8 and 10 or something like that. Little boy, little girl.
Miles is 9. Flora is 7.
Thank you for bringing your notes. That was a test and you passed it. She's like, okay, meets the rest of the crew that's there. There is a housekeeper called Hannah, played by Tanaya Miller. There is a chef played by the always charming Rahul Kohli. The groundskeeper played by Tahira Sharif. So as she's there, she starts to figure out something weird's going on. There seems to be creepy stuff going on. Everybody doesn't want to talk about some things. They don't want to talk about the previous nanny that was there, really. Or they don't want to talk about someone named Peter Quint, who we see early on is played by Oliver Jackson Cohen, used to work with the father. Both the parents are dead. They died in a not named accident of some sort while they were overseas. Henry Thomas is the uncle who's setting all this up, but himself won't step foot in that house. As it goes on, we see that this nanny who's going to have to deal with something ghostly at this house has a ghost of her own. And apparently it is the character Elijah Wood played in Sin City. It's just like him. He's got the curly hair. He's got the round glasses that are constantly glowing. I was like, that's Elijah Wood's murder character from Sin City. Am I wrong?
I thought he looked like a graphic novel character.
Okay, so what do all these things mean? Well, this is a Mike Flanagan product, which means we're going to parse them out, the clues out, little by little, while you're constantly staring at the screen, because you know, if you saw the last series, there's ghosts hidden fucking everywhere in this. And there is. I caught a few this time. I was like, there's a ghost! There's a ghost over there! Look over there in the window! There's one in the blender! It was like that.
Constantly doing the Leonardo DiCaprio meme, like at Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like, oh, burnt them right there!
Exactly. As it builds, we get given more information. We start to figure out maybe who the ghost was for the nanny. We start to figure out maybe why she's seeing a ghostly Peter Quint who seems to be appearing, who everyone is like, well, we don't think he's dead. He made off with a shit ton of valuables and money from the house. The police are searching for him, but she's like, well, if that's Peter Quint, then he's dead. So the mystery of what happened, all those things, if you've read Turn of the Screw or seen an adaptation of Turn of the Screw, you already know. It's not until you get to about the halfway point of this that this starts taking some pretty drastically different turns, as you would expect from this Flanagan recontextualized horror series, and starts adding on to mythology, which has a lot. Well, basically, it turns into a season of Lost.
Yeah, I'd say that.
Is that, did you, I mean, even with the sound, like there's this, like all this time flipping, like, and it goes every time, and I was like, it's Lost, baby! It's the hidden chapter of Lost! We never saw this season.
Why isn't it a haunted house?
We're like already 7-8 minutes in, and I haven't even said hello to my fellow critics. That's right.
Hello, everybody.
And Bob.
Hello, guys.
And the Bradley Barton.
Hello!
If there are any other Bradley Bartons out there, you must meet him in single combat so he can defeat you.
There can be only one.
It's not headless. You just take a little pinky finger, but still.
Yeah, it's at most it's rock, paper, scissors, and we apologize to the loser.
You take them to the government office and stand over them while they change their name legally. Yeah, that's
right
about it.
Right now.
All right, guys. So there's been a lot of mixed feelings about this one, certainly out there. I have talked to and seen people who have come at this going, I like the first one, but I thought the second one totally spoke to me and was beautiful and haunting and made me cry. And I talked to people who said the first one is one of the best, scariest horror things ever on television. And the second one isn't scary at all. And it was kind of corny. I kind of fall somewhere in the middle, although I will say I think the first season blows the second season out of the water altogether. I think it is a much better work of television. It's just much more consistent. It's much less cogent from other sources. This is a lot of stuff that feels like it came directly from other stuff. I don't want to say the term ripped off because, you know, save that for when things are definitely ripped off. And I don't think that was the case here. But it's a mixed bag. And it also, though, by the end, I'm going, this wasn't really made for me. This is kind of more of a gothic romance. The first one is If 6 Feet Under. was a horror show is the first season.
Yeah.
This one is more like, I don't want to say Lifetime Network. That makes it sound like it's something really shitty.
Yeah, that sounds like it's like, bad.
There's a real gothic sort of like historical adventure show that people love.
Oh, Outlander.
Like, Outlander. It's like an Outlander type of thing. I was like, okay, this is more for that crowd. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. These are two separate seasons with different flavors because they're not directly connected. But at the end, I was like, I'll definitely rewatch the first show. I'll probably never come back and watch this again.
I would agree with that. I personally liked it still actually quite a bit. I thought it complemented the first season really well, where it makes me remember why I loved the first season a lot, where it was very thrilling and scary, and I loved all the characters. And in this, I loved all the characters still. A couple here and there that I thought could have been fleshed out a little bit more, even though they're ghostly. But
fleshed out ghosts?
I think that it kind of drops the ball towards the end where they're trying to wrap things up a little bit too quickly. I understand the impact of like what ends up happening in the end, and it ends up becoming a little bit overtly melodramatic. I still liked it because I loved all the characters enough. I'm like, well, you already got me, so whatever. But I do believe it's not scary, like really at all. Like there's a few like jump scares. I was like, oh shit. I think you're kind of hitting the nail on the head, is that it's more of a gothic horror romance. And that's what even one of the characters says, is that this is actually more of a love story than a ghost story.
It's trying for something completely different than the first season is. And it's hard for me to really blame it for what it's doing, because I think it's doing it very well, but it's just not as much my type of thing.
Speaking of the romance, though, even in season one, I thought the characters had better chemistry and made better grand speeches about love also. There's a lovely monologue in this that works for a TV show, but I thought, that's kind of weak compared to season one. Everything seemed a lot less, like just the word less, compared to season one. My wife took pictures of my face during the Clockwork or Ghost sequence in season one, and I look terrified. And this, my face is more like, to the people who are watching this video, like this watching.
Picture Bradley Martin just bored to death. Did you guys see
a ghost? Was there a ghost? Another problem for me is I've read The Turning of the Screw, being, very well read myself.
I even saw the prequel with Marlon Brando.
Yes. Well, you also are the Bradley Martin, so we would assume that you've read the book.
Yeah. But I love the ending of that story. That's a weird, haunting story. Mm-hmm. If it is, in fact, a haunting, whoa! But yeah, I'd say 4 or 5 episodes into this, it hard lefts, like zoom.
Is it interesting that he did? I didn't even think about this, but both these stories he adapted are ambiguous in their ending about whether or not there were any ghosts at all. I didn't even think about that. But both seasons, I would say, decidedly say, yes, there were.
Yeah. I really like the ambiguity of those stories. There not being any ambiguity at all, that's fine. I think that's okay. But this was so boring to me. And I don't know, I feel like a buzzkill. Michael Flanagan's thesis on love is terrifying to me. Like, if I told him my love story, he'd be like, but are you really in love? I mean,
did you punch her then?
Yeah, you don't sound tortured enough to be in love.
You know, Bradley, people confuse love and possession all the time. You know, as a horror fan, I think like some of you, I know this story. I did see The Turning earlier in the year, but in my defense, there wasn't much else out.
No one's going to blame you for having seen a crappy movie, Bob.
One thing that I did like, I think that was coherent and a neat way to tell the story, is the smash cut. In films, a jump cut is when you switch scenes real quick. A smash cut is usually used in dramatic television nowadays. The Leftovers used it real effective, where you have a character thinking of something and then we cut to something else and switch back real quick. It's also used in sci-fi a lot for time jumps. There is a lot of smash cuts in this, and at the beginning, I'm not going to say it put me off or anything like that, but I really thought it was going to be gimmicky. But one thing that I liked about the writing was the execution of the visuals. I think that was really impressive. It's part of the reason I liked the Haunting of Hill House so much, is because even if you know at a certain point early in an episode or in the middle of a scene what's gonna happen, the stuff we all really glam onto is the stuff that doesn't seem like it's pushing you there. That was really well done in this. I'll echo some other stuff. You know, I think a couple of the relationships made me feel at a certain point in the first 4 or 5 episodes that we're going from, okay, everything's cool. Okay, no, this is spooky. Okay, this is the emotional scene. It seemed kind of perfunctory comparing it to the first season, which may or may not be fair. I will say for Flanagan, I have a big relationship with him with endings. I love the end of Oculus. I did not care for the end of Dr. Sleep. There's a little license, you know, in the last page of the book and in the last frame of the movie. So when it came to this, I was really interested to see where we were going to go. My highlight of it, without getting too far into it, is episode 8. It is a black and white, 75% voiced over prestige television.
Axel Carolyn was the director. Leia Fong?
Yes. She's also a producer on the show, and she wrote this episode.
Flanagan only wrote the first episode, weirdly. Although yeah. I think his dad or brother or something wrote the second one. So
I think episode 8 was high watermark for the series. They were doing weird stuff. We get this idea that it's your time to die and you don't, then maybe you missed your chance to. And that's like high level concept stuff. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, the Frighteners did it.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a cool
favorite, yeah. And so in dramatic TV, which is what I'll call this, it was great. I think it was gothic's probably the word to use. Was a little confused why it was set in the 80s.
Yeah, but they didn't want the wraparound story to have like hover cars flying by. Oh. You know, everybody loves the 80s. Yes, I had to live through that shit. Okay, I'm telling you, it was overrated. We had Duran Duran, we had roller skating. Those were great. Other than that, in retrospect, everything wasn't all that hot. We all agree this is very gothic. I think we're all on, at the very least, it's good, but not as good as the first season. It's not trying to be the first season, though. There are certainly similarities to be found here, above and beyond just the cast and the name. But he is going for something different, and I know plenty of people who are just madly in love with this, who are like, I can't wait to watch it again. I was so swept up in it. I guess it's good, much like American Horror Story, if you're doing a horror anthology show, that you try for different things. I just hope his next one, he goes for out and out terror. I literally tweeted at him today, so you're doing Hell House by Matheson next, yeah?
Some of the actors in it this season I thought were phenomenal. Like the actress who plays Hannah, the housekeeper, I thought she was fantastic. The au pair, the lead, I guess you could say. Her reactions to things, it looks like she is equally terrified and about to cry, but also about to hug you at the same time. She is so intense to watch. And like every time I'm watching her on the screen, I'm like kind of, oh fuck, is something going to happen? And just like, cause I wasn't prepared. I didn't know exactly what the fuck was about to happen with her. I thought she was really good. And the kids were pretty good. I thought they were okay. They're they had a lot to do in this series.
Having seen a lot of adaptations of Turn of the Screw, the kids are pretty much always played this way. Oh, yeah. Why, I see it's you. Come on in. Let's play, shall we?
That doesn't tip you off as an American? Like, wait, hold on.
No, it's England, man. All the kids are fucked up.
I think that's probably a good point, too, about the kids and it being enjoyable. There's such a big chunk, especially of the first half of the story. But if you know this story, there's not a lot of surprise in what's going on there.
Right.
So people who don't know this story or at least won't realize, because I can't believe they name drop Turn of the Screw at the very beginning. But
yeah. Well, they do it in the novel. Or the person telling the story of the story.
And this is filled with turning and screwing.
Hey-o.
Well, that's one thing. This is one of the most... There's a lot of fraternizing among the staff. I don't know if that's common on English manners, but...
Oh, it's common everywhere.
Oh, they actually said it in the show itself. Like, at one point, someone mentions the show Upstairs, Downstairs. I'm like, that's what this is. This is Upstairs, Downstairs meets a gothic ghost story. It's like the crossing of those two things.
You know, good on the kids, because they weren't getting a lot of watching.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to final thoughts. Right, get us started.
The one thing that did throw me off at first, and then I got used to it pretty quickly because it's just how kind of preposterous it was. Henry Thomas, his accent was so foppish, like, hello there.
People are complaining about that, and every time I see someone complain about an English accent, I reminded my friend Baz, who lives there, who's like, And next time you're confused, just ask me, because there are like 400 different English accents.
True. Yeah,
like,
true.
And an Englishman will tell you exactly what like square mile of England they're from by their accent.
Right. And, you know, I'm not faulting for it. It's just jarring when you first hear it.
People are like, it's bad. I'm like, is it? I don't know.
It's better than my accent, so yep, I give him props.
That's what I said.
Good or bad, he didn't have a lot to say.
It's a jolly holiday with Mary.
Anyway, so I did like this season, for the most part, quite a bit. It moved me in a lot of ways that I was not prepared for, definitely towards the end with some of the relationships that were blossoming between different characters. Obviously, this was not really nowhere near as scary or really that scary at all, except for a few moments of like just, I think, more dread than anything else that it was building up to. And so I was just kind of like sitting back with a little bit of an unease. In the end, if you're going to watch this show, definitely watch it for, like you were saying, Bob, like the visuals are really incredible for the most part. Like they know how to shoot this damn show, and definitely last season as well. And some of the characters are really great to watch and see their stories unfold. This is a good season to kind of warm up to even the first season if people are usually afraid to watch horror movies or horror shows. Maybe start with this one and then kind of ease your way into second season or the first season instead. In the end, I think I'll give this 7 out of 10 eyeglasses that definitely should throw in the fire.
Bob?
There's a lot of stuff I really love. The biggest compliment I have for the show is to the Newton brothers who scored it. In the age of how much we've streamed in the last several months and years leading up to it, I watched the entire season and rewatched 2 episodes and never skipped the intro. I was a really big fan. It's a very slight and spooky melody that we'll hear all the way through the series. But
I hope they use the Dust Brothers for the next one.
That would be Chemical Brothers would be great.
Yeah,
they can do a horror story in a rave, I'm sure.
Sure.
One thing we got this season is a much greater focus on death. I think we had more characters this time, and we for sure had more dead characters throughout the season than we did last season. It was a love story, and that gets pushed in the literal exposition of the show. The turn of the screw, having read or not, you know, isn't going to surprise a lot of people. I think that's a lot to do with how scary it is. Like Chris said, the first season was such a departure from the novel. Even going in, you know, you were excited about what the difference was. This one's just kind of vanilla until they make it not vanilla, and there's just not very much of that. So I'm going to go 7 out of 10 smash cuts.
Brad!
Very cool, smash cuts. I did enjoy this. I watched it with my wife and mother-in-law. Love watching stuff with them. They enjoyed it a whole lot more, and that kind of affected my rating because I was like, I want to be scared. I don't want to find out who's banging who. I don't care.
But which version did you watch, by the way? Because we watched this, and did you watch the porn parody? Or did you...
No, of course not. Anyways.
His wife and mother are just crying watching the porn parody. They're so in love. What's this called? The screwing? I love it.
The turning of the screw. That's great production value.
The screwing of the turn.
Yeah. Every happy endings for all. I love this house. The manor is gorgeous. The grounds are beautiful. The kitchen is amazing. I hope if I ever make it big in life financially, I can buy my wife a kitchen like that. While thinking these thoughts, I felt, wait, aren't I supposed to be scared? I don't know. I can't get over that hurdle. This isn't scary at all, and it's kind of boring to me. The housekeeper, for example, she cleans this whole manor by herself. There's like 40, 50 acres of land and rooms everywhere and staircases sweeping and grand. And she's cleaning this all by herself. And then by the end of the whole thing, that's an even bigger nitpick, which it shouldn't be.
Should look like Downton Abbey with the amount of staff that you have to cover.
Just
right?
Got a duster. Like, yep.
Maintaining I got this. Or she should have been dusting like this.
She does like a wing a week or something.
And the kids were fine. They were perfectly splendid. But I don't know. They should have been a little menacing, right?
I mean, Miles was pretty menacing.
Yeah, points. I suppose. He just seemed like a brat to me, which is correct. I will say, I do love it when hauntings are actual choices people made in their past, and they're haunted by them. The show's an A+ on that matter. I liked everybody's past and backstory when they delved into those. I thought that was the most unique way of telling a haunting. Until the ambiguity drops And Flanagan or the showrunners or the writers are like, no. It's not ambiguous. Ghosts everywhere. Ghosts are out to get you. Boo. And it's just, I don't want to say silly because I did love this cast. I'll stop ranting because I could go on for hours, nonsensically even, and say, for me, this is 680 pairs of mom jeans out of 10.
It's like you doing this review is season 3, The Haunting of the Bradley Martin. Yeah. He just is rambling and going from one thing to another. It's like he didn't like it, but then it's like he really liked it, and we don't know what's happening, and oh my God, what is behind him?
Yeah, British guy shows up. He's haunted, he is. No, he's possessed by a ghost.
What is it, Governor? Oh, bad knob. Red barrel.
Why didn't we do this review all in our best British accents?
Our best, worst British
accents. Because no one on the show did.
I've already said pretty much everything about how I feel. I mean, it's upstairs, downstairs that meets a gothic romance that halfway through just whole swallows the last couple seasons of Lost. We're going to make this part of it now. My feelings about this are that I want to look for things that are wrong with it, and there's not anything technically wrong with it, really. Mm-hmm. It's just gradually more and more does things that just aren't my cup of tea overall. The gothic romances can be done very well. There's examples I really like of it. There's gothic romance without the ghosts, like Wuthering Heights, that I think is wonderful. This is almost too tropey with it all, but it's not written quite well enough to get away with that sort of hyperbole. Even like you were talking about, Bob, how much you liked that black and white episode. And I was like, this was exactly what I was afraid they were going to do. And once again, nothing wrong with it, but I saw it coming a million miles away. When you wait till the penultimate episode to say, and now here's the origin of the hauntings. I'm like, okay, all right, fine. Get it out of the way so we can wrap this sucker up. I thought this was just okay. It's beautifully shot. It's really well acted. But you just look at the credits and I'm like, wow, Flanagan really stepped away from this one. He was like, yeah, I'm executive producing it and I'll direct the first episode and write the first episode. But after that, it's y'all's. You do what you want. And it feels like it. He was much more deeply involved with the first season. It's okay. Yeah, I'm going to give it 6.5 out of 10 Greg Sestero from The Room cameos that I bet nice. You guys missed.
Oh, hi, haunting.
I was like, no way. Is that Greg from The Room? It is. I mean, we didn't actually. I mean, come on. It would have been better if we had actually gotten Tommy Wiseau to come in as one of the ghosts.
As the lady in the lake?
Yeah, right?
Inspired casting, I'd say.
I would have been all for that.
When the doctor takes the mask off, if that had been Tommy Wiseau, oh, man.
Oh, hi.
You say you see ghosts on grounds. You're talking crazy.
I was tanned apart, which is why I'm a ghost.